seek new hope, new life in a new country. As might be expected, women reacted to frontier life with varying degrees of enthusiasm.
Fort Calhoun, Nebraska Territory, September 18, 1856. My dear Uncle and Aunt, well, Uncle Van, the time has come, the good time we used to talk about, when we are settled in our home, where I am monarch of all I survey, of my rights there is none to dispute. Fort Calhoun is our stopping place. It is situated on a beautiful plateau on the Missouri River, 16 miles from Omaha. Well, the house is a huge log house, 12 by 12 on the inside, well chinked and daubed. The front door faces the east in the Missouri. We have a view of the river from two points. Now perhaps Camille and others of the girls think, well, I don't see how Phoebe can be willing to live in such a heathenish country. Well, my good gracious girls, we are not at all out of this world. People think, act, talk, walk, and holler hurrah for Buchanan, just as they do in the States exactly. And I know if you all had as good husbands and loved them as dearly as I do mine, you would be happy in any place with them. They say contentment is happiness. If so, then I am supremely happy, as indeed I am.
Consider it the greatest swindle of the age, and am praying every day for its dissolution. Goodbye. Write soon. Yours till death, Amy M. Green.
German and Czech immigrants, newly arrived from the old world, experienced typical frontier adventures.
In the month of October, 1859, I went on a hunting trip accompanied by Christian Anderson and some Iowa friends, Peter Kuhl and Carl Klenzer. We were so dead tired when we arrived at Wood River that we preferred to beg for a night's shelter with one of the Mormon settlers instead of putting up our own camp. The man at whose place we obtained shelter had erected his residence under the ground. This cellar-like dwelling was perhaps 12 to 14 feet wide and about 20 feet long, and roof raised only slightly above the ground. Our Mormon, still a comparatively young man, to date had but one wife, but he had already had 12 children. I believe there must have been several sets of twins. All the young ones looked so very much alike that the father himself became confused, mistaking Dick for Jack, and again Jack for Bob, and Bob for Bill, and so on. The evening meal was ready, and we were invited to take our places at the table. We naturally wanted to pitch right in, being really very hungry. But we had reckoned without our host, who began to pray, "Our Heavenly Father, we thank Thee for the many blessings which we have so abundantly received from Thy hand this day." And this seemingly endless litany was like a tapeworm coming out of the fellow, and the sultry air began to make me drowsy. Suddenly, the roof began to crack over our heads, becoming worse and worse, and in a few moments, large quantities of dirt and hay came falling down upon us and our knees. The next moment, a large ox broke through the roof with all 4 feet, but remained hanging with his belly across one of the rafters, bellowing piteously. Our cave father was naturally wholly enraged and stared at the ceiling. When the ox had settled down so that he was kicking with all 4 feet above the table, the fellow, who was still praying, clenched his fist, which he shook threateningly at the unfortunate ox and thundered a mighty oath. Our meal, of course, was done for.
I became acquainted with Mr. and Mrs. Brabenet in Chicago, Illinois, in 1869, at the time when a society called Cheskaw Colony was founded. Our goal was the country in what is now Knox County, Nebraska. Well, we each put up a shack on our land, that is, a dugout covered with brushwood and reeds. We men decided to fell some of the slender cottonwoods growing by the river and build a log house on each claim. We worked with a will, happy to think that we will have good and stable homes. At about 3 o'clock, we heard several shots which seemed to come from Brabenet's dugout. To our horror, we saw a group of Indians riding rapidly in the hills toward the valley. We hurried to the dugout. When we got there, at first we could see nothing wrong. Prashek and I entered the dugout and saw Mrs. Brabenet apparently dead, lying on the floor. We carried the poor woman out and tried to bring her back to life, which we accomplished in a little while. The poor, wounded woman, who continually called for her children, Caroline and John. I went with the men to look for the children. We walked through high, thick grass, and about 100 feet from the dugout, to our horror, we found the dead body of Johnny Brabenet lying on the bloody grass. We could not speak or act. After a while, we were able to get our friend to go to his wounded wife, and Prashek and I set out to look for Caroline. And surely enough, we found poor Caroline Brabenet. She had been shot in the breast with a well-aimed bullet. We returned to Brabenet, and as evening was coming on, we took space, being careful that Mrs. Brabenet should not see us. And while the sun was setting, we prepared the last resting place for the little Johnny and Caroline Brabenet. And so, the blood of two little children was laid on the altar of the bloody sacrifice which gained for us our Western country.
For thousands of people, the Great Plains region was the promised land. And of course, where there were people, there were souls to be saved.
Sutton, Nebraska, October 31st, 1872. My darling wife, last Sunday I preached at Sutton in the morning in a hall over a drugstore. Sunday evening I preached in a new unfinished schoolhouse 7 or 8 miles northeast of town. The audience sat upon boards, and ends of which rested upon boxes and sawhorses. I never had an audience listen to me with such unbroken attention. Indeed, If I could preach in a dozen different places every Sabbath, I could find audiences eager to hear me. I reached Harvard late at night in the midst of a hard rain. 12 miles from home, too dark and stormy to think of attempting to reach home. No acquaintance in Harvard. No alternative but to go to a hotel. Night, cold and rainy. Miserable hotel, miserable bed. Only one miserable quilt on miserable bed. Spent miserable night. Up in the morning early. No fire in miserable house. Rainy and cold. Shivered round till miserable breakfast was ready. This evening, the miserable landlord charged me $1 for all this misery. Walked home 12 miles through rain and cold. Thus, I went a distance of 22 miles, paid railroad fare one way, 95 cents, hotel bill $1 for the privilege of preaching twice for nothing. This is Mission Life. Your loving husband, Ike.
For women especially, it required courage to leave home and friends forever. Even in the 1890s, Manhattan, Kansas, seemed the end of civilization to a wealthy and aristocratic British bride.
First day, October the 8th, 1890. It was exciting to me to be arriving at Manhattan, the place which was to be our first home. But then Hoppy jumped out with all our array of small parcels. Stuart Buggy was there, a serious-looking man in shabby clothes holding the horses. This was James Taylor, Stuart's chum. We drove straight to Stuart's rooms over his office. Stuart had been hearing about houses from Christie, one of his clerks, and was so anxious to be off to see one, he could hardly wait for me to have a cup of tea. Manhattan looked quite pretty. All the streets except Main Street were avenues of green, with houses peeping out of the trees and bushes on either side. Suddenly, as we turned a corner, I saw one of the wheels roll off, and the next moment we were down in the dust. There was no memory, so after a good laugh, we started walking to the stables to get another buggy. We saw two houses and decided on one belonging to Mr. Newell in Houston Street, the fashionable street of the town. It was not quite what we wanted, but there was nothing better to be had. November 1890. I was very busy getting my little drawing room into order. It is a bright room with windows to south, east, and west. Are some Dagestan rugs, and I have a piano and a little table covered with plants. I generally come in at about 5 o'clock, put on a tea. But oh, it makes me long for someone to come in and share it with me. Some of my own friends and not these dull Manhattanites. A good many people call on me, but I have not made friends with anyone yet. I think most of them come out of curiosity. Some are just like servants, sit on the edge of their chairs, very conscious of their best clothes, and can only say, "Yes'm, it is so."
The frontier was certainly a man's world. Nevertheless, the men were quite willing, even eager, to share it with the women.
How to choose a husband? Why, girls, that's the most important question in your life. I will tell you my experience. I was raised on the frontier, where the men outnumbered the girls 6 to 1. At 15, I began teaching school. I was far from handsome, but I always had my share of beaux. My first admirer claimed love at first sight. I was so upset that I told him there was someone else, which was not the truth. One cowboy I really considered seriously. He was a charming fellow, but I finally decided I couldn't spend my life with a man who said, "Had went and I done," for after all, life is made up of little things. The ranch foreman roamed into my life next. He was the scion of an aristocratic family, good-looking,
well-educated, but he had a past. And when I heard that, my interest ceased. Next came this drop box. We all thought a lot of him, but he could not let liquor alone. The girls blacklisted him and refused to dance or play with him. The country began to settle with Grangers, and I was offered a better school in another neighborhood where I met a new circle of young people. Still, the men outnumbered the girls 4-1. Three of them became attentive. The first one to call seemed the most desirable, but he soon proved too mushy. Wanted to hold my hand and spoon without any preliminaries, whatever. The second was Rich, but he got his dismissal quickly, for he insisted on coming to the schoolhouse, courting. Number three offered his company and seemed to be all right. He was quiet, but not bashful. Good to look at, too. Able to take part in the debates and other stunts at the literaries. He was a general favorite with the older people and had a keen sense of humor. He was a Christian, the first I ever had for an admirer. Who was he? Well, he's been my husband for nearly 30 years.
But ultimately, it was youth and hope and courage that conquered the plains.
Sherman County, Nebraska, October the 8th, 1885. Dear Mother, you wanted to know how I liked my new home and how I was getting along. I like Nebraska first rate, wouldn't look at $1,000 for my claim. I will tell you what kind of a house I lived in last winter. It was a sod house, of course, and if it didn't look pretty rough, I don't want to see anything that does. There's lots of other bachelors, but I am the only one I know who doesn't have kin folks living handy so that they can help in the cooking. You wanted to know when I was going to get married. Just as quick as I can get money ahead to get a cow and to get married if I can. My girl's name is Eddie Terhune. She is 18 years old. And she is a good girl and knows how to work. A fella can't do much good on a new place when he has everything to do, both indoors and out, both. November 27th, 1885. Well, to start on, I will tell you of a wedding we had in these parts on Thursday, November 19th. Miss Eddie Terhune to Ed Donnell, all of Sherman, Nebraska. Yes, Ma, it is a fact. I was married the 19th at 2 o'clock. We went to Loup City, got the license, went over to the parsonage, and was married by a Methodist minister. It seemed so much nicer to come into the house and find everything nice and clean. I think that I have one of the best little women that there is. We haven't got so very much in our house, but she makes everything look neat and tidy and is willing to help me all she can. November 24th, 1886. I am so sleepy I can't hardly hold my eyes open. Eddie has been sick, and I have been setting up a good deal, and we have one of the prettiest babies you ever saw. She was born Sunday, October the 24th. My Bible has no records in it, and I wish you would put it down in the Bible at home. There is not many churches here yet, but I don't think it is any closer to hell than it is any place else. For my new well is 125 feet to water, and it is almost as cold as ice. I like to have churches and go to them, but I don't think God requires people to stay in a country where they shake their liver upside down, or where they can't make a living, or have a home, just because they have churches. For my part, I like to have a little help, and something to eat, and try to lay up something for a rainy day and old age. Your loving son, Ed.
These were the naked plains beyond the bleak Missouri. Now clad with grains, jeweled with orchard, grove, and greening garden, serene abundance centered in the heart to nurture lusty children. Courage was the winnow that separated the strong from the weak on the western frontier. The courageous stayed. The restless adventurers moved on, and the weak abandoned their prairie homes to return whence they came. The winning of the West was not a glamorous battle. When the first flush of adventure paled, it was the heroism of drudgery, monotony of a day-to-day encounter with poverty, loneliness, frustration in a land where nature often frowned. Such was the heroism that won the West for those who were to follow. Such is our heritage of courage from the great plains.
Take a look around you, boy. It's bound to scare you, boy. Yeah. Tell me. McGuire's recording of Eve of Destruction has sold more than 1 million copies around the world. He says it's because of what the song and this generation is thinking and saying.
They're saying, hey, stop, look around. You know, they're saying, it's not this way. They're saying it's not what you say it is. They're saying, leave me alone. You know, quit trying to tell me what's right and wrong. That's okay for you, but let me find out for myself. You know, because it's not working for you. If it was working, then nobody'd be getting killed. But what you're trying to teach me is right isn't working. You know, and they're tired of that.
I think they're in a jam down in Vietnam. Now get gone. My people down there don't dig Uncle Sam. Get gone. Ruled by the people just can't do wrong. Get gone. Jefferson said that. And the people down there are the Vietcong. Eisenhower said that. And you're wrong, Sam Scram. Don't you know you better get gone, baby?
For many of today's youth, such songs express the mood and meaning of this music. For others, it has become big business as well. Of the significance of a particular song or of the entire movement cannot be measured alone in dollars and cents. What is perhaps more significant is the impact it's having as a force for social change. More on that in our next report. Dave Dugan, CBS News, New York.
Thank you. Thank you. love life.
Thank you.